It's Jimmy Buff with you, and on Tuesday afternoons, we're doing the Tuesday Afternoon Book Club. We are, great pleasure, airing chapters of an extraordinary book called Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. It is the writings of David Fleming, edited by Sean Chamberlain. And, you know, we're in the present, right? We look at the news every day, and we're outraged, and we're focused on the latest outrage coming from the White House or some such place. But the future is where it's at, and what kind of future we're going to have when, as the title suggests, that the market economy, the aftermath of the market economy. It's a compelling read. It's a compelling listen. The audiobook is done by Sean Chamberlain, and we've been airing some chapters of it so far, courtesy of Chelsea Green, the publishers, and we're now up to chapter two. And so we're going to play chapter two. It's a long chapter. It's one of the longest in the book, and it goes for a while. And there's such an amazing and dense and wonderful array of information in this chapter that you're going to want to go back and listen to it on the archive once we air it today. Peter Buffett will be along, too, to talk about what we hear after chapter two airs, which we're going to air right now. It is called The Lean Economy.
Chapter two, The Lean Economy. The Lean Economy. The fabric of the life of society. An economy held together by richly developed social capital and culture, and organized around the rediscovery of community. It is a fusion of society and economics, based on presence and cooperation in a slack social order. Building from small groups and household production, through the neighborhood and community in its many forms, to the nation. It sustains solutions. All the lean responses discussed in this book are set in the context of a key assumption. Local communities will not have access to government funding for any of their needs. They will not have an income that enables them to buy in the goods and services they need from outside the locality. Inevitably, there is uncertainty about the extent to which local lean economies will be forced to rely on their own resources, with the range between deep local, where they cannot get supplies even of tools and metals, and local light, where most or almost all routine needs such as food are produced locally, but the equipment needed to do this can be bought in. Surviving the Future's position on this spectrum is towards the deep local extreme, though some opportunities that would arise under less extreme assumptions are noted. Writing of Thomas Hobbes's famous system, The Political Economy of Leviathan, Michael Oakeshott notes, "If it requires great energy of mind to create a system, it requires even greater not to become the slave of the creation." That is, it becomes necessary to think consistently through the logic while recognizing that it might turn out quite differently. The lean economy is not a forecast, it is a scenario. A protocol for lean economies. The conventional economist's ideal of perfect competition can be summarized in seven conditions. In order for it to exist, there must be 1. No local intervention, such as government regulation to set standards, and no discrimination, except on grounds of price, against another producer. 2. Standardized products, so that all products compete on price rather than on differences in specification. 3. A large number of sellers and buyers, and all of roughly the same size, so that none of them can influence prices. 4. Free entry and exit. Sellers and buyers may come and go as they wish. 5. Profit maximization. Sellers do not have any agenda other than making money. Buyers are irresistibly drawn to the best deal. 6. Perfect mobility of the factors of production, so that labor, capital, and land are distributed according to price. They are free from other entanglements and strings. And 7. Perfect knowledge, so that buyers can perfectly evaluate the quality of all products on the market. Under these conditions, prices are set and resources are used with smooth efficiency, unsullied by human error, by economic boundaries, or by principles and agreements of any kind, other than those of comparative advantage and competition. This does the theoretically useful job of opening the way to the greatest possible efficiency. The economy is taught, there is Pareto efficiency. It would not be possible to make better use of its resources and assets. Any gain made in one place would be at the cost of loss in another. Economists do not claim that this ideal of perfect competition ever happens in real life, nor that the rigorously defined equilibrium enabled by it can actually exist. As a leading authority in the matter, Frank Hahn remarks, "The economy cannot be in this state." Nor do they even believe that, in practice, the existence of perfect competition is really desirable. For a start, it would rule out the existence of large companies. Differences between brands of the same product would have to be banned, as would natural monopolies such as railway and electricity networks, however competitively they were structured. Nonetheless, perfect competition is the idealized baseline against which distortions, disequilibria, rigidities, and the market failures which are suspected of causing unemployment are identified and defined. Competition itself is a defining property of the market economy. It needs no justification. And just in case it did, it would be necessary only to point to the fact that producers who are not competitive have to raise their game or cease to exist. An alternative seven-point protocol. The lean economy, by contrast, will violate all seven conditions listed earlier. The impediments to perfect competition will be greater than ever, and this will be intentional. There will be slack. The ideal conditions of the post-market economy, those of intelligent, imperfect competition, are summarized here. Condition 1, local intervention. Intervention to protect the local economy and to build trust. Protecting the local economy. Protection is the act of caring for something which you value or for which you are responsible. It is a deep behavior which, in some senses, is shared by all living things. It is widely supposed to be a good thing, except in the case of economies, which are required to dance to the single tune of perpetual competition. True, natural selection is a condition of all living things too, but species with less intelligence than ours use both. It is time we caught up. On such matters, market economics is far from neutral. It takes the view that the competitive market is the only sound basis for economy, politics, and culture, and it advocates its case with evangelical conviction. If there is a society somewhere which is not based on the market, it needs to be saved. All the 7 points of this protocol for lean economies are implicitly or explicitly about the task of protecting the right of such economies to proceed on a different basis. In a taut, competitive, growing market, it is true that protectionism is not a good idea. It reinforces inefficiencies and reduces the incentives for improvements in quality, economics of scale, and reductions in price. It discourages the development of technical advances and specialist skills, and it freezes flows of trade and capital, setting up conditions for national and global unemployment. But, of course, there are circumstances in which free, unprotected trade is not what an economy needs, and we are coming to a time when they can be discussed without inviting derision. One of them occurs where an undeveloped, thus far uncompetitive economy needs time to get its industries established before exposing them to international competition. In the early years, a developing region with an industry which is still too new to have developed competitive levels of efficiency is unlikely to survive without some advantage, such as a weak currency or tariff protection. Another case where unprotected trade is not what is needed is when we have to move away from the commitment to growth, i.e. to the rubbing out of diversity and local self-reliance, to resource depletion, pollution, the loss of social capital and resilience, and eventual collapse. It is too late to consider protection against these things. The damage has already been done. But protection of what is left of indigenous food production and steps towards reduced dependence on fossil fuels would be rational. As E.F. Schumacher writes, protection here is not about keeping alive activities which lack essential viability. It is concerned with creating a new viability. The lean economy, whose sharing out of work makes it inefficient by design, would quickly be destroyed unless protected from the competitive rigors suited to profoundly different conditions. It will be inherently uncompetitive in two main ways. First, full-time work as standard practice will be obsolete, and much of the work that is done will take the form of participation in the informal economy, where members provide for each other and cooperate on terms which do not involve money. Secondly, its range of technologies will include labour-intensive production methods which would be priced out of existence in a competitive market. Labour intensification for its own sake is not advocated. It would make more sense to get the job done quickly and to spend any spare time smelling the roses. But the benefits of labour-intensive methods apply widely, and they include reduced energy dependence, simple equipment, suitability for the small, local scale, greater eco-efficiency, better food and improved soil, and a higher quality of craftsmanship. In summary, the lean economy will be slack, producing less per working man and woman than it could produce if it were able, like the industrial economy had been, to keep the majority of the working population at work full-time and with competitive efficiency. Sustainable slack will be an immense achievement, more significant in its way than the Industrial Revolution's invention of unsustainable work. But that brings us back to the key problem. Slack economies are vulnerable to taut economies, a version of Gresham's law which says that bad money drives out good money. Here, the market state, in which price displaces cooperation and reciprocity, drives out social ecology. This is the tragedy of economics. And slack economies, once destroyed, do not become taut economies. They become broken economies. They will need protection. Building trust. Money will have much reduced significance in a local lean economy. Prices don't work well in a slack economy, because if everything were priced, slack would mean high prices, and there is always the temptation to give in to buyer's pressure to reduce the price, especially if the buyer is outside the community. In the lean economy, culture of cooperation and reciprocity, exchange involving money is not the rule, but the backup. The significance of such a change is hard to overstate. The market economy's money exchange is impersonal. Until they get into the bigger, longer-term transactions such as rents or employment, the two sides of a money transaction don't have to trust each other. And even then, there are ways of dealing with the situation if things go wrong. In contrast with this, the informal economy of the neighbourhood would break down immediately in the absence of trust. It is the core economy, consisting of all the things we do for each other in families, cooking, bringing up children, playing, discussing citizenship, building character and emotional literacy. All the things we do as citizens, serving as school governors, organising societies and sports clubs, voting. All the things we do as friends, offering lifts, providing accommodation, counselling grief. The things which, taken together, add up to our social capital, greatly diminished though it is today. The lean economy will depend on the informal economy, and it, in turn, will depend on sustainable trust, the confidence that an obligation, explicit or implied, will be honoured. The central collaborative task of the local lean economy and of the politics beyond it will be to build that trust. And yet, trust cannot be made. It is a slowly growing outcome of getting other things right first, like lichen that grows on a wall if you leave it undisturbed for long enough. It requires permanence, with people being in the same place for a long time. Deep trust, able to survive stresses, to support substantial cooperation, and to sustain intense deliberation, requires the foundation of a common culture and identity. The task of supporting that culture is itself a form of sustained intervention in the way in which people interact with each other. In other words, the community will protect its culture as the foundation for trust, which in turn will be the key enabling property of its economy. Condition 2. Product diversity. No product is quite what it seems. A local shop provides a subtle mix of services. Gossip, help for old people, surveillance of the street, accessibility, along with the groceries. These extras have to be paid for in higher prices. It is not only the disadvantage of being unable to buy in bulk that makes the corner shop supposedly inefficient and expensive. It is the labour-intensive presence of the shopkeeper and all the intangible services he supplies. They are a public good from which you benefit whether you buy from him or not. The problem is that customers, though aware of these things as local facts of life, appreciate what they are getting only when they are no longer getting it, and the local retailer is able to sustain them only because he is a mini-monopolist in his area. His freedom to charge a higher price to cover the cost of the extras would wane or cease if a super-cheap superstore opened up which could not provide them. Those subtle enlargements, strings attached to the goods provided by the local shopkeeper, are seen through the spectacles of neoclassical economics as impediments to the ideal of perfect competition. As the sociologist Richard Dawe writes, such diffusion of goodwill and mutual consideration is feared as creeping malevolence and abuse of monopoly power. However, in the local lean economy, the attachment of such strings to products and services will be seen as desirable. That is to say, there is no standardization. The product's identity acquires just the sort of blurred borderlines that perfect competition cannot abide. Economics is word for the other things you get, whether you want them or not, along with the economic output that you pay for, is externalities. That is, goods and bads that are external to the price system. Carbon emissions are an undesired externality. The friendliness of the local deli who will keep your keys for your daughter while you're out is a desired one. Much of environmental economics is about finding ways of internalizing externalities, giving prices to externalities, so that better prices, which represent the reality more accurately, lead to better decisions. But even if externalities are priced, it is still the market that makes the decisions, as buyers search for the low prices which suit them. Lean economics, in contrast with this, deals with externalities directly. There is full awareness among citizens that products and services come encumbered with strings, and they may be exactly what the community wants, such as the advantage of richly encumbered enterprise keeping local traders and the local economy solvent. In local lean economies, consumers know that there is more to be said about the product than what it says on the tin. Here is an extract from Garrison Keillor's Lake Woebegone Days, which understands well the importance of getting more than you bargain for. When the Thanatopsis Club hit its centennial in 1982, and Mrs. Hallberg wrote to the White House and asked for an essay from the president on small town life, she got one. Two paragraphs that extolled Lake Woebegone as a model of free enterprise and individualism, which was displayed in the library under glass. Although the truth is that Lake Woebegone survives to the extent that it does on a form of voluntary socialism, with elements of deism, fatalism, and nepotism. Free enterprise runs on self-interest. This is socialism, and it runs on loyalty. You need a toaster? You buy it at Co-op Hardware, even though you could get a deluxe model with all the toaster attachments for less money at Kmart in St. Cloud. You buy it at Co-op because you know Otto. Glasses you will find at Clifford's, which also sells shoes and ties and some gloves. It is trying to be the department store it used to be when it was the Mercantile, which it is still called by most people because the old sign is so clear on the brick facade, clearer than the Clifford's in the window. Though you might rather shop for glasses in a strange place where they'll encourage your vanity, though Clifford's selection of frames is clearly based on scripture, take no thought for what you shall wear, and you might put a hideous piece of junk on your face and Clifford would say, I think you'll like those, as if you're a person who looks like you don't care what you look like. Nevertheless, you should think twice before you get the Calvin Klein glasses from Vanity Vision in St. Cloud Mall. Calvin Klein isn't going to come with the rescue squad, and he isn't going to teach your children about redemption by grace. You couldn't find Calvin Klein to save your life. If people were to live by comparison shopping, the town would go bust. It cannot compete with other places item by item. Nothing in town is quite as good as it appears to be somewhere else. If you live there, you have to take it as a whole. That's loyalty. Condition 3. A small number of sellers and buyers, with a lot of influence over the local market. The divided self of the market economy shows in the fact that the laws of competition apply only to production and not to consumption. While producers are under pressure to be efficient, to maximize output from a given input, consumers are under corresponding pressure to be inefficient, to maximize their input, their consumption, for a given output of well-being, so as to soak up the ever-growing production which the economy needs as a condition of its stability. In its essence, the lean economy will take the form of a radical transformation away from this division of purpose between producers and consumers. Each of us is, after all, both. The divide between supply and demand loses its focus and to a large extent breaks down. Here we have a human ecology that does not consume. It chooses. It behaves. It lives. And yet, there will also be craftsmanship and specialization, and a market will be needed to link them up. But the local lean economy's markets will be small markets, with small numbers of sellers and buyers. Just a few of them could influence prices or some other aspect of supply and demand. Many trading relationships will be specifically organized as reciprocal arrangements between, say, a producer and a small group of households. Terms will be agreed on a case-by-case basis with little reference to prices elsewhere. For instance, local people, in their role as producers, may take a position on reduced working time or on carefully maintained community self-sufficiency, while, in their role as consumers, accepting the costs of this, as well as the necessity for it. All this is in contrast with the price-taking, idealized in the model of perfect competition, where nobody has any influence on prices. In the large and impersonal market, the only economic behavior that makes sense is an abstract pursuit of wealth, crematistics, to use Aristotle's word for this. In the short-range local economy, by contrast, the intention is to promote the interests of the household and community in practical ways, in line with the roots of our word economy. From the Greek, economia, ekos meaning house, and nomos, managing. Any money you make out of it is at most secondary. Money is not the point of the exercise, and much of what you do, everything you do for your family, for instance, is for no money at all. For economia, price is often irrelevant. Economics in this core sense is beyond the reach of the parsimonious summaries of mathematics. It depends on judgment. Condition 4. Barriers to entry and exit. A helping hand for loyalty. There are two types of relationship between customers and suppliers. First, there is exit, to get out at the first sign of bother. This is how the market economy is meant to work. Secondly, there is voice, to argue for change, to influence matters by getting involved rather than by walking away, to stay loyal. Such loyalty is a vital asset in the lean economy. And it is given a powerful helping hand by barriers to exit, where conditions exist which make it hard to get out. One barrier which has shown itself to be effective in many cases is geographical remoteness. The decline and fall of the small island economy of Inishbofin off the west coast of Ireland illustrates this. With local economic self-sufficiency in virtually all their needs, the islanders maintained a millennium or two of resilience until the coming of the market economy. Inishbofin's low-tech fishing boats were no match for the trawlers. Its farmers, who needed to sell at least some of their output in mainland Ireland in order to buy the goods they needed, were no match for industrial agriculture. And as the islanders, as consumers, became aware of the market's products and prices, They had, as producers, less and less to offer. They resisted for a time, since the island's remoteness provided a big incentive to rely on what it could produce for itself. But when the lower prices, the wider range of goods, and the convenience of the market in mainland Ireland was made more accessible by a massive EU-funded pier, that was the end. Not that it could have been avoided. The people of Inishbofin could not conceivably have access to modern consumer goods and services from their own resources, except with the help of imports and subsistence payments. And without those, the islanders could reasonably be expected simply to leave. Life on the island formerly was hard, beyond the expectations of our own time. And yet, unemployment and dole dependency is hard too. When the subsistence payments can no longer cover the costs of living, or when they stop altogether, life on the island will be harder still. Decisions which have profound long-term consequences are often made on the strength of short-term opportunities which, with hindsight, people would not have chosen. And barriers to entry and exit, such as the inconvenience of living on an island without a modern pier, or of living in a remote area without a modern road, mean that the temptation to take the actions which will destroy the local economy does not arise. This matters, because when that chance of giving in to temptation comes along, it is grasped with both hands. The momentum of small, seemingly harmless choices is powerful and virtually unstoppable, and the final result has to be accepted without a murmur. Alfred Kahn called it the tyranny of small decisions. Where people make decisions on the basis of the easy options now, without making the connection with the consequences to which those innocent choices will eventually lead. Massive long-term consequences, such as the tearing down of the trade barriers which have protected a local economy for centuries, come along as unforeseen implications of little decisions about how you and the dog want to spend the afternoon. In a society used to cheap travel, and to the idea that destruction is a good thing, at least when it comes to boundaries and the rhetoric about tearing down barriers, the idea of closed access at first invites unease. There is a sense both of being locked in and of unfairly locking out. But in fact, it works the other way. Almost wherever you go in the market economy, you find yourself in the same place, in the globalized market with its shared banality, its fullness. At the end of every lane is a busy road and a housing estate like the one at the beginning of it. You cannot get out of a globalized world because there is no out. Closed access does not mean closed in. It means the protection of distinctiveness. When you are out, you are somewhere else, in a different inn. Travel now finds its purpose, taking you to a place which is not in essentials identical to the one you have left, but to one that is interesting and finds you interesting, that wants to hear your song, that dances to a different tune. Barriers to entry and exit, aka sustainable protectionism, are restrictive of freedom, but only in that they prevent people from walking into the trap of the small decisions by which they would destroy what they value. Barriers to entry and exit also have the effect of creating insiders, people who belong to a group, and who have an incentive to stay there. One good barrier to exit from a locality is that members should want to stay inside it. Enjoying being an insider can improve matters even more. In the Tuscan city of Siena, membership of one of the 17 contrade means being strongly identified with the locality and belonging to a culture of intense loyalty. Loyalty cultivates benevolence. And in Siena, it is built into the local communities, held in place with the help of the exuberant ritual of the Sienese horse race, the Palio, and by the fantastically cumbrous political channels that surround it. The Palio is unquestionably a barrier to entry and exit. For instance, you need to be born in a contrada to be able to claim to belong to it, and you need to participate in Palio politics for your belonging to mean anything. The rivalry between contrade is playful, part of an actual texture of loyalties, both within contrade and between them. The lean economy will have barriers to entry and exit thrust upon it. localities will be hard-pressed to provide for their people, especially in the early years, and would quickly fail if overwhelmed by numbers. If you are already in a functioning lean economy, you are likely to need and want to stay there. Loyalty, writes the economist Albert Hirschman, can be compared to such barriers as protective tariffs. There you have it. Loyalty means having the good sense to hang on despite short-term disadvantage, not taking too much notice of price signals, a deliberate inverse of perfect competition. It implies an economy where price does not have the final say. Protection recovers its proper sense of stewardship. Local lean economies will depend on it. Condition 5. Multiple aims beyond profit maximization. There has for a long time been the presumption that, as representatives of the shareholders, managements have no right to pursue objectives other than that of maximizing profit. And yet, that simplification is well out of date, since other obligations, to the triple bottom line of economics, environment, and social justice, for instance, are already recognized. The idea that a producer in the lean economy should work in the interests of the locality and its complex needs is therefore an evolution of current management principles rather than a contradiction. Many businesses are already providing local services, productively encumbered with complex local aims. Community-supported agriculture is one example. In the lean economy, the distinction between producer and consumer will be weak. As the household and neighborhoods build their competence, the two functions will merge. Profit, in this context, has little meaning. Condition 6. Barriers to mobility of the factors of production. The three factors of production in economics are labor, capital, and land. They will all be scarce. There will be plenty of people around, but labor that brings the skills and the trust that local lean economies will need will be prized, and efforts will be made to keep it in the community. At the same time, communities will not be able to assimilate new arrivals, which would raise their numbers beyond what they can sustain. The first principle of an enduring commons is closed access. That does not mean a closed-minded lack of hospitality and trusting encounter. Relationships bridging between communities and forming a network of learning and mutual support will be fundamental to the evolution of the lean economy. What it does mean is that the community recognizes that a feasible and effective commons requires control of boundaries, restricting access and scale to numbers that the resource can support, with participants that accept the obligations that this requires. The size, growth, and technical powers of the market economy have insulated us for a time from having to think about the limits to the various kinds of capital that we depend on. There therefore seems to be no need to think about the cost of protecting them. Maybe we can all be free riders, benefiting from assets which we have done nothing to produce or protect. We can affirm a liberal right to be a free rider. It is an attractive, inclusive philosophy. It would be immoral to disagree with it. Until, that is, it comes face to face with the laws of physics. There are 6 forms of capital in lean economics, allowing for some slight fuzzy boundaries. Natural capital, the living ecology which nature provides, including soil fertility, water, fish, material resources, the whole of the ecosystem and its climate, the essential conditions for a living earth. Human capital, people and their capabilities, qualities, and knowledge. Health, intelligence, education, character, skills, beauty. Human capital has an important potential for growth, both through reproduction and hard work. And that work can itself multiply by making tools and technologies which, if enough natural capital is available, can then in turn produce more tools and technologies, an amplifying or positive feedback. Social capital. The typical textbook definition here is the set of institutions and customs which organize economic activity. But the textbook's authors are thinking of the market economy as the well-behaved process by which society is sustained. For surviving the future, by contrast, what matters is community itself. Social capital is the social life and living essence of a community, The relationships, humour and good faith, the common culture and ceremony, the play and conversation. And it is the organ grinder. The market economy is the monkey. Scientific or cultural capital. This is the information and culture available to be grasped and applied. It is only capital to a society that can understand or use it. Material capital. Buildings, roads, equipment, computers and their networks, etc. But again, for something to qualify as capital, the conditions must exist in which it is useful. For example, energy famine could cause oil-fueled equipment to cease to qualify as capital. Cars could become simply rather curious-shaped objects. And financial capital. There is a case for omitting financial capital, because its value depends on and is a representation of the existence of the other five forms. It is included because to some extent its existence is independent. A financial crash can occur for reasons notionally unconnected with the other five. The connections, however, would be revealed as the crisis rippled through to the point of greatly reducing or destroying other forms of capital. So it is useful to have it in the list, despite the double counting. Now, one of these forms, the scientific or cultural capital, has the property that it can travel to another place without leaving the place it started from. Like love, which you can give and still have, or commerce, whose supply knows no limit. And it will be important to the network of local lean economies that they should, with ease, share ideas, information, and culture. Apart from that, capital in the lean economy is subtractable. If you give some away, you have less of it. And it will tend to be immobile. The idea that capital should be mobile is not recent, but it became routine rather than the exception following the influence of the economist David Ricardo, 1772 to 1823, who made the case for comparative advantage. That is, for the production of each kind of good and service to be concentrated in the places where it can be done most efficiently and cheaply. According to this principle, the efficient nation will make things for its own use only if there is nothing else, either for home consumption or export, that it could produce more efficiently. Such dislocated economics is a natural feature of large-scale civic societies. Located economics is a central principle of the lean economy. Capital, in its various forms, recovering from the breathless globe-trotting recommended by Ricardo, will come home and underpin resilient communities. Land, in economics, stands for the whole set of miracles and services which comprise the planet. As John Stuart Mill summarized, labor can do no more than move things around. The properties of matter, the laws of nature, do the rest. However, this vast but vulnerable endowment has been taken for granted, summarized as land, and reduced to a residual which, in the models and equations, can be left to look after itself. And as land, of course, it can be owned and inserted into a business plan somewhere. So that, in this sense, land in economics is mobile too. In the lean economy, land will stay in one place. Condition 7. Imperfect knowledge, making a virtue out of ignorance. Perfect competition requires perfect information about all the products on the market and how they are sold. The local lean economy, by contrast, will be largely ignorant of the goods that other consumers can buy in other places. Passive consumer awareness of out-of-season strawberries will be replaced by intense knowledge of the range of goods, food, and skills that the place they live in can supply. And at a time of substantial uncertainty, knowledge will be rare relative to inference. Knowledge, in a sense, is the final product, packaged and ready for use, and lean economies would be stuck without some of that. But economies and lives alike will depend, as the Duke of Wellington described it, on working out what you don't know by what you do, guessing what is at the other side of the hill. The first steps towards self-reliance will be to explore and infer at a time when certain knowledge is scarce, and when the idea that you can perfectly evaluate the quality of all products in the market is a relic from another age. And there is something to be said for not knowing how big an almost impossibly big project is going to be. If you knew, you probably wouldn't start. Post-market economics. Imagine that you are at home in your small town or community in the years after the climacteric. International trade has substantially failed, taking the financial institutions with it. There is very high unemployment. The government cannot sustain unemployment benefits and can fund virtually nothing. Tax revenues have crashed. This is a society with, by the standards of the affluent market, no money. Local economies depend not on what they can buy, but on what they can do. If their response follows the alternative 7-point protocol just described, local economies will be working to principles which are, in a sense, the inverse of those of the market. Now for a bit of reductionism in the positive sense. Forget for a moment all the other problems that would arise in such a situation, and concentrate on how to get the local economy moving as a system that can support life and community. There are two structural supports. The first one is reciprocal exchange, consisting of obligations, duties, loyalties, and the exchange of services not organised around money. The second is the cultural setting, which gives the community an identity, and around which reciprocities and cooperation can form. These are described in the next chapter. What we need to consider now is the economics underlying this. That is to say, the ways in which the community's resources, labour, land and capital, might be utilised. The demise of the market economy will affect the demand for labour. The effect will work in two directions. Factors which will tend to reduce the demand for labour will include the reduced supply of energy and materials. Labour is complementary with, i.e. depends on, materials and resources. If the supply of these were reduced, there would be less for labour to do. The consequence could be a large-scale close-down of the industry and services on which the economy depends. And the small scale of the local lean economy, its minimal infrastructure, its elegance. This drastically reduced scale is the key to the feasibility of life after oil, but it has the corollary that the bulk of work currently required to sustain the infrastructures of the market economy will no longer be needed. On the other hand, there will be factors which tend to increase the demand for labour. They include the reduced supply of energy and materials, again. Labour is also a substitute for materials and resources. If the supply of these were reduced, there would be more for labour to do. Labour will do, by hand, work which was previously done by energy-driven equipment. The scale of this effect is not predictable. It is plausible to suppose that at least some of the electrical apparatus on which we rely, such as hand tools and saws, will have power supplies from local renewable resources. But no assumptions can be made about the availability of good equipment and spare parts. Other kinds of work, such as farming, lacking abundant flows of oil and gas as fuel and feedstock for fertilisers and biocides, are also likely to be more labour-intensive than they are at present. There is also the task of energy provision and conservation itself. Much of this will consist of building the equipment and installations needed for the zero-carbon economy, which will call for a lot of labour, although this will tend to become less when the task is essentially one of maintenance. The net outcome of these effects in terms of labour demand can be debated, and it will undoubtedly vary depending on timing and circumstances. Indeed, the whole question of reducing unemployment in an economy by increasing the demand for labour takes on a different and ill-defined meaning, where there is free movement of labour with other economies 10 times or even 100 times the size. Surviving the future's position is that, in the settled form of the lean economy, the factors which reduce the demand for labour will dominate, by a large margin. At this point, it will be helpful to consider a concept from today's economics. The intensification paradox. This is the observation that a developing economy, whose productivity is improving, actually requires increasing quantities of labour and land and capital to keep each individual supplied with food and shelter. At first, this seems odd, because those productivity improvements, perhaps through improved technology, mean a significant increase in output per person, which surely represents an improvement in efficiency. The explanation is that the increased output goes primarily into creating and maintaining what can be termed intermediate goods. Aqueducts, transport, landfill sites, administration, etc. That is, all that new stuff which the individual never actually gets to consume, but which becomes necessary infrastructure for keeping the developing, the intensifying economy in existence. To demonstrate this, a quick story about how complication builds from the innocent desire for a few more pots. More pots leads to more transport, which leads to more transport infrastructures, which leads to more tax to pay for the roads, which leads to more bureaucracy to raise the tax, which leads to more jobs available in towns, which leads to larger towns, which leads to dislocation of rural social structures, which leads to relaxation of sexual rules, which leads to a higher population, which leads to a greater need for food and resources, which leads to military power and conquest, which leads to a flow of wealth into a growing society, which leads to more pots. Here we discover the crucial distinction between labour-saving productivity advances and intensifying productivity advances. Those early productivity advances, which actually arose mainly from a massive increase in working time, were ploughed into intensification and its attendant multiplication of infrastructures. And that process, with varying degrees of intensity, has continued in our economy ever since. In a large economy, it takes more work, more stuff, to keep you, dear listener, alive. This intensification paradox has been elegantly summarized by Marvin Harris. Intensification inevitably leads to declining efficiencies. In the de-development that lies ahead, this effect will be reversed. As the economy de-intensifies, it will become more resource efficient. It will require less labor, energy, and land per person. In other words, the small-scale elegance of the lean economy will lead to a collapse in the amount of work available or needed per person. The lean economy will never be able to provide full-time work for the whole of its workforce. There will be hyper-unemployment. In such a slack economy, spare labour, more commonly known as spare time, is not a problem of unemployment, but a property intrinsic to the life, culture, and social capital of the place. Yet, in the absence of government subsistence payments, the economy will have to adapt in order to prevent underemployment leading on to starvation. Lean economics is the means of maintaining the stability of an economy which does not grow. Its institutions are designed as essential means to manage and protect its small scale. One way to do so is by sharing out the work with restrictions on working time, as was required through the medieval period. Another is to absorb spare labour with standards of practice such as organic production, which combine labour-intensive methods with other benefits such as high quality and low environmental impact. Such methods may also be the natural outcome of scarcities of energy and equipment. Or to supply goods for the purpose of destroying them, or to produce goods of monumental extravagance such as pyramids, cathedrals, or carnivals. We will discuss all of these further in part two. Stabilizing a slack economy is hard. It can be done, but not by using only the instruments visible to economics. The lean economy will both underpin a common culture of reciprocity and freedom, and utterly depend on it. Without a firm basis in well-defined competitive pricing, culture is the key.
That's a heck of a last line.
It sure is. Culture is the key. Absolutely.
It's Jimmy Buffin, Peter Buffett, and that's chapter two of Surviving the Future, The Lean Economy. I've read it a number of times. I've listened to it a number of times. And each time I do, I get a better understanding of what David Fleming and Sean Chamberlain are talking about when they talk about the lean economy.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting to listen to a book versus read it, because when you're reading it, you can go back and read that again and go, wait, what? Let me think about that for a second. And that's interesting because, of course, he delves further into the idea of Slack. And that's part of Slack, is being able to stop for a minute and think and wonder and imagine. And so there you have it. There's a lot to take in that chapter. Feel free to listen again because you'll get something more out of it. I know when I'm listening, I'm reminded why this book is so inspiring.
Yep. And we can take this moment to point out that hard copies of the book are available at Rough Draft in Uptown Kingston.
Yep.
And the audiobook is available for purchase as well. And there is so much to try and distill in that chapter that I think an overarching idea for me is that a lot of what they're talking about in the lean economy comes down to trust.
Exactly. That's, as I was listening and thinking and taking notes, trust was it. And actually, the folks at Black Lives Matter have a phrase, moving at the speed of trust. And that's exactly what we're talking about. And as I listen to this chapter too, I'm encouraging the listener to kind of blur your vision a little and get a little fuzzy and imagine this town, Kingston, in this place of a place other communities already find themselves. When he talks about government won't be there as a savior, essentially, those are my words. But, you know, he's saying that deep local is about looking to each other, building trust over time, and creating the things we need, that we become the producers and the consumers that we actually already are, but have lost so much of the art of that. And it's really all about trust.
Yeah. And another sort of sub idea is loyalty, which is maybe an offshoot of trust.
Right. It's right? Like a cousin or something.
Yeah, cousin. And that's where, you know, so many people don't trust. They don't trust government. They don't right. trust systems because they haven't been served by them. You and I shared a podcast recently, a section of a podcast done, Sam Harris Waking Up podcast with Yuval Noah Harari as right. the guest. And he talked about people feeling irrelevant, being more afraid of feeling irrelevant than of being exploited.
Exactly. It was stunning because he also brings it to this point of, after you get past about 100 people, you don't really know anyone, right? And so what about your neighborhood? What about the people closest to you? And the idea that in this increasingly automated world, the factories don't need you anymore. Like you're saying, I mean, in the old days, it was solidarity around exploitation. And now it's this individual feeling of, do I matter at all? And that's where culture comes in. That's where community comes in. And you start to feel a part of something. And I love the conversation around having walls around a community, not to exclude or keep out, but to feel special and connected. I mean, all of us, when we go to the airports look the same. When we fly to the next city, the cities look the same. The streets look the same. I mean, we have homogenized ourselves sort of into irrelevance, because what's the difference between here and there? And in this community, in Kingston, I think we still hold on to some of that.
Yeah. And the fact of the matter is, in the lean economy, as described in this chapter, everyone participating, you have to be relevant. You have yeah. to have a purpose in this economy. And I think that's a goal for people to understand, is that when you start to participate in this scale, in this little area of ours, that you matter.
Yeah, absolutely. You bring something uniquely yours, and it doesn't have to be reduced to an amount per hour or some kind of abstraction. It's you being there, you being present, you taking care of someone, you holding the keys, like you said, for somebody when they come home. You know, these small relationships as opposed to transactions. And I think that's a lot of what we're talking about. There's a phrase that I love, and I probably said it already on another one of our conversations, but the abstract without the particular allows the demonic. Did I say that last time too? I think I did, but I probably say it every time.
It's a great, it's worth repeating.
Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the particulars of place, of people, of culture, of celebration, all these things that really do matter versus where do I get this thing for the lowest price?
It's Radio Kingston, 1490 WKNY. I'm Jimmy Buff. That's Peter Buffett. We've just listened to Chapter 2 of Surviving the Future called The Lean Economy. And then next week, Chapter 3 is The Lean Culture.
Excellent.
Thanks, as always, Peter, for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And if you want to hear the previous editions of our Tuesday Afternoon Book Club, where we're airing chapters of Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy, go to RadioKingston.org, click on the Archive tab, drop down to Jimmy Buff Loves You, and you can hear the first section, which was the introduction, the editor's preface, and the and another part. And then also Chapter 1 the following week is there as well. Well worth following along is this is the airing of these chapters of Surviving the Future, written the words of David Fleming and edited by Sean Chamberlain. And thanks to Sean Chamberlain also for allowing us to air the audiobook in this fashion.